was in effect over by February of 1787, but the residuals, isolated incidents of violence, the trials of the rebels, and then the pardoning of most of the rebels, were still taking place as the delegates appointed by the various state legislatures began appearing in Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention. In May 1787, the initial delegates from Virginia and Pennsylvania arrived in Philadelphia, the largest city in America at the time. The Philadelphia of 1787 had a population of about 45,000 people, with major streets paved in brick or stone, with sidewalks of brick or tile, which were fenced off from the streets with posts every few feet. Half the produce and trade of America passed through Philadelphia at the time. It was idyllic in some ways, although it had its seamy side. Theft, murder, and mugging were common in Philadelphia. And like other major cities with closely compacted populaces, Philadelphia was highly susceptible to epidemics. 6 years after the convention, 4,000 Philadelphians, or about a tenth of the population, died in a yellow fever epidemic, polluted well water. And one Philadelphian complained that dead dogs, cats, and fowls, and the offals of the market, were among the cleanest articles to actually be found in the streets of Philadelphia. Dead animals, horses, and cows, were left to putrefy on vacant lots. Thrown in with the pigs roaming the streets to consume this menagerie of street refuse, and one gets the picture that Philadelphia in 1787 was not the prim and proper setting we sometimes see portrayed in movies. This was the Philadelphia that George Washington and the other delegates came to in May of 1787. Washington hesitated in coming, for fear that if the convention failed, it might damage his reputation. He was also in the midst of very trying times in his personal life. His brother had just died, and his mother and sister were seriously ill, and he himself was suffering so much from rheumatism that he was barely sleeping at night. But he was convinced that something must be done to rectify the articles, and despite carrying one arm in a sling from his rheumatic pain, he left Mount Vernon on May 9th and arrived on May 13th in Philadelphia. His way from Mount Vernon was described as a royal progress, with cheering crowds lining the roads as he passed, and his carriage attended by so many horsemen that he couldn't see the countryside for all the dust being kicked up. He arrived in Philadelphia to the sound of artillery salutes and bells and was escorted into Philadelphia by the Philadelphia Light Horse Troop. As Washington entered Philadelphia, there was a 13-gun salute, church bells were pealing, and the crowds lined the street to see this great man, who already in his lifetime had become somewhat legendary. His reception in Philadelphia reminds us again that Washington could have easily, and with a warm reception, become essentially an American king. His officers had tried to press that upon him in the closing days of the Revolution, only to see Washington resign his commission to the Congress. But suffice it to say that when talk came to the executive position in the new government, it was conceded by every delegate at the convention that Washington would be the first executive of the United States. Washington would make his way through Philadelphia to stay with Robert Morris, a close friend and another delegate to the convention. 74 delegates were originally named to this convention, but only 55 would come. 12 states were present, though New Hampshire's delegates would not arrive until late July. Rhode Island and Providence plantations refused to send delegates, primarily because the state legislators in Rhode Island knew that they needed to uphold state sovereignty in order for the paper money to have any value. Remember that many of the state legislators were advancing their interests with the paper money and were adamant that no strong national government could impose upon them. It can be said that the 55 men who came to Philadelphia in 1787, the greatest assembly of American statesmen ever. In today's terms, it would be like Congress approving a conference of the brightest and the best in America, college presidents, CEOs of large corporations, distinguished public servants, social scientists, judges, and successful entrepreneurs to come together and discuss a new form of government. That's essentially what the Confederation Congress did. When suggested to them by the leading men of the day that the current form of government was failing, that Congress approved the convention, and quite frankly, it resulted in the Confederation Congress being run out of business. At the time of the convention, 4/5 of the delegates were or had been members of the Continental Congress and the Confederation Congress, and several had served as president of that body. 8 of the delegates had signed the Declaration of Independence. There were 8 governors or former governors in attendance. 35 were lawyers or had benefited from legal training, Some were judges, other attorney generals of their state. 13 were merchants or businessmen. 12 owned or managed slave-operated plantations or large farms. Several were small farmers. 3 were physicians. Several were scientists. And at least 4 had studied theology. Only George Washington and Robert Morris could be considered truly wealthy, though there were others who were extremely well-to-do. Many of the delegates came from leading families, though some, like Roger Sherman, Alexander Hamilton, William Patterson, and Luther Martin, were self-made men. With such a vast array of talents and experiences, Thomas Jefferson, kept abreast of the convention details by Madison, rightly called the convention an assembly of demigods, although we should never forget that they were very human, with vices and virtues, strengths and weaknesses, all of which would be on display in Philadelphia. Many were young men, and I think this is something that we often forget. At the time of the convention, Charles Pinckney of South Carolina was 29, and in a somewhat humorous side note, Pinckney afterwards tried to lie about his age, because he wanted the honor of being the youngest delegate. Alexander Hamilton of New York was 30, Rufus King of Massachusetts was 32, Jonathan Dayton of Maryland was 26, John Francis Mercer of Maryland was 28, Gouverneur Morris of Pennsylvania was 35, and James Madison of Virginia was 36. The average age of the delegates was roughly 44. Benjamin Franklin raised that average considerably by being 81. Some of the great figures of the Revolution were noticeably missing. John Adams was in England at the time, serving as the U.S. ambassador in the court of King James. Though it should be noted that Adams' defense of the constitutions of the government of the United States had a prominent place in Philadelphia that summer. The Philadelphia Mercury, beginning on May 18th and for every Friday after that, devoted its entire front page to excerpts of Adams' book. Madison didn't think much of Adams' work, however, and I quote, "Men of learning find nothing new in it, and men of taste find many things to criticize," unquote, Madison wrote. Somewhere in the background, I seem to hear hissing and snarling when reading that comment. Thomas Jefferson was the U.S. ambassador to France. Patrick Henry was elected as a delegate from Virginia, but he refused to come, saying he smelt a rat. Other leading men of the Revolution, John Hancock, Richard Henry Lee, and Sam Adams, were also absent from Philadelphia. Eventually, only 39 of those 55 delegates would sign the Constitution. But even then, they weren't all there at once. They were coming and going. And many times when the debates were taking place, there were only 30 or 40 men, maybe even less than that, present in the room. It was almost like a large committee meeting discussing the revising of the Articles of Confederation. By May 24th, enough delegates had arrived in Philadelphia for the convention to declare a quorum, and the next day the convention officially began. It's important to remember that the revising of the Articles of Confederation was the reason that these men were present in Philadelphia. However, within days of the convention beginning, it would become very clear that some of the delegates from the large states had ideas that went well beyond simply revising the Articles. Now, I'd like to list off all of the delegates and give you at least a brief description of each one. Some of the names you'll recognize, others are more insignificant figures, but worth noting because at the time, they were obviously considered leading men in their respective states. Out of Virginia, which was the first delegation to arrive in Philadelphia, George Washington was considered the leader by virtue of respect, and once quorum was reached, Washington would be unanimously elected as president of the convention. Though Washington spoke only twice on the convention floor, once to accept the position of president of the convention, and the next on the day of the signing of the Constitution, Washington's role and influence at the convention cannot be underestimated. When the convention would encounter difficult times, and talk arose of the convention disintegrating, respect for Washington kept the convention together. It can be rightly said that George Washington and Benjamin Franklin were the giants of the convention. James Madison, who I dealt with in much more detail in previous podcasts, is called the father of the Constitution. He was a tiny, slight man, described as being no bigger than a half piece of soap. He was a tireless advocate for a strong central government, and he came to the Constitutional Convention with a plan to not merely revise the Articles, but radically change them and, in essence, do away with them. He came up with the main ideas behind the Virginia Plan, which in turn became the framework for the Constitution. It was said of Madison that Mr. Madison is a character who has long been in public life. Every person seems to acknowledge his greatness. He blends together the profound politician with the scholar. George Mason, a neighbor of George Washington's, was one of the great figures in Virginia, having 5,000 acres and over 200 slaves. Despite his slaves, Mason was actually very much for the abolition of slavery. However, he was fearful that a large central government would trample upon the rights of the individual. Mason would be one of the three men present at the signing of the Constitution who would actually refuse to sign the document. Edmund Randolph, the governor of Virginia at the time, was also a delegate to the convention. Only 33 years old at the time of the convention, Edmund Randolph was well respected and played a large role in the convention because it was he who introduced the Virginia Plan. Along with Mason, Randolph, though responsible for introducing the Virginia Plan that provided the framework for the new Constitution, would end up not signing the document. James McClurg was a well-respected physician from Virginia, who had an interest in politics as well as medicine. When Richard Henry Lee refused to go to the convention, McClurg gladly accepted a seat on the Virginia delegation. At the convention, McClurg supported extensive executive power and independence from congressional control. He left the convention in early August and did not sign the Constitution. After ratification, McClurg served on Virginia's Executive Council, but he never again attained a role in national politics. George Wythe was the first scholar to receive the honor of serving as the first chair of law at the College of William and Mary. Perhaps the most notable achievements gained by Wythe was the fact that he trained Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe, and John Marshall in law. Although he attended the Philadelphia Convention, the 60-year-old Wythe was not an active participant in the debates and left early, without signing the Constitution. He did, however, work for its ratification. The final delegate from Virginia was John Blair, who actually ended up coming because Patrick Henry refused. John Blair was a member of the Supreme Court in Virginia, and at the Philadelphia Convention, Blair attended faithfully, but he never took the floor and never served on a committee. In 1789, George Washington would appoint Blair as an Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, a position that Blair would hold until 1796. The Pennsylvania delegation's leader was Benjamin Franklin, the president of Pennsylvania at the time, and at 81 years old, the oldest delegate to the convention. The irony of the matter is that when the Pennsylvania delegation was voted upon, he was actually not included on it at first. It was later decided as a courtesy that he should be part of the delegation to go to Philadelphia. William Pierce, a fellow delegate at the convention, wrote of Franklin, "Dr. Franklin is well known to be the greatest philosopher of his age. He is no speaker, nor does he seem to let politics engage his attention. He is, however, a most extraordinary man. It is also said that he was better known across the world than Voltaire or some of the other great names of the age." Franklin, in poor health at the time of the convention, was transported by a sedan, literally a chair with two long poles alongside enclosed with glass. Four prisoners would pick up each end of the poles and transport him around Philadelphia to Independence Hall. Robert Morris, called the financier of the Revolutionary War, was the merchant prince of Philadelphia. He played a very important role in finance. Gouverneur Morris was one of those geniuses who every form of talent has combined to render him conspicuous in public debate. Nicknamed Peg Leg for having lost one of his legs in a carriage accident, Morris was also called Tall Boy. He was over 6'2" and was a close confidant of Washington's. A brilliant orator, Morris became the penman of the Constitution. The irony is that Morris was almost not elected to the convention. A delegate at the convention said of Morris that he throws around him such a glare that he charms, captivates, and leads away the senses of all who hear him. Morris's life, before, during, and after the Constitutional Convention, merits an entire podcast devoted to him, which I will do later in this series. Jared Ingersoll was another delegate from Pennsylvania and was a very able attorney and possessed a very clear legal understanding. A man of extensive readings, Ingersoll proved to be a very minor player at the convention. James Wilson was one of these six men to sign both the Declaration and the Constitution. A native of Scotland, Wilson had come to America before the Revolution and had risen to prominence as a politician. He reached the apex of his career at the Constitutional Convention, where his influence was probably second only to that of Madison. Rarely missing a session, he sat on the Committee of Detail and in many other ways applied his excellent knowledge of political theory to convention problems. Only Gouverneur Morris would deliver more speeches on the convention floor. Washington later appointed Wilson to be an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. Wilson's story is a fascinating one, from being a poor immigrant from Scotland to one of the leading men of the day in America, to ending his life on the run from the law while being a sitting justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'll deal specifically with Wilson in a later podcast. Thomas Mifflin was a major general in the Continental Army and later would be a president of the Continental Congress. Though he is considered a talented politician and speaker, he did not play a substantial role in the Constitutional Convention. George Clymer was a lawyer of some abilities, and though he attended most of the convention meetings, he played a very minor role in the shaping of the Constitution. The delegation from Connecticut, though it only comprised of three men, would play a significant role at the convention, due in part to the compromises advocated by Oliver Ellsworth and Roger Sherman, and by the fact that Dr. William Samuel Johnson chaired the committee that wrote the final draft of the Constitution. Oliver Ellsworth was a prosperous lawyer, and he also had served in the Continental Congress. At the convention, Ellsworth would bring forth the idea initially offered by Roger Sherman, a national legislature with the lower house based on population and equal representation in the upper house, a very key component to the compromise between the small and large states at the convention. Ellsworth sat on the Committee of Five, which composed the first draft of the Constitution. Although he did not sign the Constitution, Ellsworth was a strong advocate of it and later served as one of Connecticut's first two senators. He was later appointed Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Dr. William Samuel Johnson played a major role in the Constitutional Convention, missing no sessions after arriving on June 2nd. He was a strong advocate for the Connecticut Compromise, and he chaired the Committee of Style, which shaped the final document. Later a U.S. senator, Johnson helped pass the Judiciary Act of 1789. But in 1791, the year after the government moved from New York to Philadelphia, he resigned from the Senate because he preferred to devote all of his energies as the president of Columbia College in New York City. Roger Sherman was one of the self-made men of the convention. Born into very modest means, Sherman was determined to raise his station in life. And although he began as a cobbler, after teaching himself law, Sherman became an associate judge on the Connecticut Supreme Court. He would become a longtime member of the Continental Congress and was one of the five men chosen to draft the Declaration of Independence. In fact, Roger Sherman was one of only two men to sign the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution. He was the first to offer the idea of a compromise between the small and large states at the convention, calling for the lower house to be based on population, and then for every state to have one vote each in the upper house. Sherman later served as a congressman and senator, and in the first Congress played a role in drafting the Bill of Rights alongside James Madison. The delegation from Delaware included the colorful Gunning Bedford, educated for the bar and impetuous in his temper. He was a corpulent man and a former classmate of James Madison's, the College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton. The Attorney General of Delaware, Bedford, was an ardent small state man, and he even hinted during the convention that if the large states did not compromise on representation with the small states would consider allying themselves with foreign nations. John Dickinson, though not as well known today, was at the time considered one of the most important figures in America due to his letters from a Pennsylvania farmer written in the 1760s. The letters attacked British policy on taxation and urged resistance to unjust laws, while believing that there could be a peaceful means of reconciliation with Great Britain. A delegate to the Second Continental Congress, Dickinson would not sign the Declaration. He did, however, become a brigadier general in the militia and fought for a period of time in the Revolution. During the convention, Dickinson helped engineer the Connecticut Compromise, and although he did not sign the Constitution in person, he would later authorize George Read to do so in his place. George Read had been a member of the Continental Congress, and even though he had voted against the Declaration of Independence, he did end up signing the document. He was a strong, small states rights advocate at the convention, and a believer in a strong executive in the new government. He would sign the Constitution and become a senator, oftentimes allying himself with the Federalists. Jacob Prum played a minor role in the convention and then afterwards returned home to be the first postmaster of Wilmington. I hope at this point I've not put everyone to sleep, But I'm going to take a break at this juncture and pick up in the next podcast with a recounting of the rest of the delegates to the convention.